If you ask the best in the world the single greatest secret to success, they'll smile and give a gentle laugh. You're asking the wrong question. Being extraordinary is not a single element. It cannot be distilled down to one thing. We're told that being a success is a magical thing that happens in a place you'll arrive. The hard part is that this long-held truth is the biggest lie. Extraordinary features humans that have reached the top of their field and become extraordinary humans. The door to being extraordinary is now open. Will you walk in? Hey everybody, Jeremy here, and as always, I'm bringing you some incredible people. Today, we have a former NFL veteran with us who played for the Chicago Bears, the Miami Dolphins, and also for the Denver Broncos. Now he's in the insurance world with the insurance people, helping people to really take control, you know, of their financial world. At the same time, he's a best-selling author, speaker, and doing a lot of incredible things. Desmond Clark, thanks for hanging out with me, man.
Man, I appreciate you having me on your platform.
Absolutely. You know, man, it's funny because I just remember watching you catching those passes from Jay Cutler, man. So it's nice to finally get a chance to chat today.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It should be fun.
I want to kind of start with your upbringing, man, because you did have a little bit of a difficult road to the NFL. You know, like, how did you decide that, you know, you were going to make it to the NFL? Because you didn't really have, you know, I know this the situation's changed with your family now, but you didn't really have a great example at the time. So how did you make that decision for greatness and push for it?
Well, the decision to be successful wasn't about the NFL at all. It was at the age of 14 when I went in and I told my mom that I was going to be successful, just because all of the stuff that I was seeing around me, the stuff that my dad was going through and multiple family members, it's just like when you look around at the people who are nearest and dearest to you, there wasn't a whole lot of success there. And one day after dealing with my father, I just made up my mind that I wanted to be successful. And for me at that time, success was only, hey, graduate high school and go to college. Mm-hmm. And then as I kept going farther along and as I kept getting older, success started meaning different things. Just like now, success means something different than it did for me 10 years ago. But the NFL was just something, playing football, I'm not even going to go with the NFL.
Right.
Playing football was just a means to an end for me. And that's why I was so, I guess, competitive on the football field, because it gave me the opportunity to earn a scholarship. When I was in college, it gave me the opportunity to stay in college and see a bigger life for myself. And it wasn't until my junior year, after my junior year, when I led the ACC in catches, that I really started thinking about the NFL. It was always a dream out there, but it was never something that I was focused on and say, hey, that's my goal.
So football was really the tool to get the education.
Yeah. Listen, I'm not even going to say education. It was just a tool to be successful. And as I continued down the road and I got older, like I say, success just meant different things. I mean, you could start with education because it was, okay, if I'm going to be successful, you got to graduate high school and you got to go to college. Right. So that's what success meant, you know, back in the early mid 90s.
I guess, like, looking at that then, like, your dad did have his struggles and you did have to kind of, you know, make that decision on your own. You're going to do it. And, you know, one of the thing as well is like patterning other successful people. Like, who did you, you know, look at as a role model? Like, who did you look at as, like, you know, a support figure? Or like, what was that like for you in that time?
I don't know if there was a role model per se, but it was a lot of people that I listened to. It was a lot of people that mentored me.
Sure.
And I'm always start off with my Coach Jays, Coach Joyner, Coach Jackson, Coach Joe, and Coach Jones. Those are my middle school and high school football and basketball coaches. And those are the people that, you know, I think once I made that decision that I wanted to be successful, I opened up to those individuals because I was spending a lot of time with them on the football field, on the basketball court. And they, to me, were people that had it together. I mean, they owned a home and had lives that looked like something that I wanted to have in my future. And then they're my coaches also. So they had the other thing, the other carrot that was dangling out in front of me of playing on the field and getting better as a player. So that's where it started out. And then it graduated over time. And, you know, if you read my book, you'll see a lot of influences from a lot of great coaches. And then once I got into the NFL, you know, it started to branch out more business and political figures. So I started to be big time influences.
I can appreciate that. You know, I was always too small to play football. I'm only 5'5", man. So I don't think I would have survived well, but all my wrestling coaches were, you know, vital in my life and they helped to form me as a man. And I can understand, like, having those right coaches and those right people around you, man, it's vital to forming who you're going to be in the future.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I try to, some of the knowledge I try to impart on people for when they're mentoring kids or You know, they want to see kids be successful. It's all about getting experience and exposure. Like, mm-hmm. if I didn't have the exposure to those great men, mm-hmm. I mean, where would I be right now? And there's a lot of kids that they don't have that exposure. They're not getting that experience of being able to see someone that they can say, man, I like this dude lives. I like how she lives. I want to listen to him or her because him or her, they're telling me, he or she, they're telling me all of these wonderful things about good I can be and how great life can be only if I do this and mm-hmm. and having the chance to buy into it. Everybody don't have that exposure and experience. And I believe that's one of the keys to success, not only for kids, but mm-hmm. also for adults.
Well, I guess then looking at it, Des, like, you know, you had your college career at Wake Forest. You were then drafted in the sixth round by Denver. That draft experience, what's that like? Because you were a later round pick. So that's got to be stressful, right, man. Like, what is that like?
No, it wasn't stressful. My agent had told me if it was a good draft for tight ends, I would go like maybe fourth round at the highest. Mm. If it's a bad tight end draft, I would go sixth round. So the big two tight ends that everybody was talking about, neither one of them got drafted. So it was a wow. bad draft for tight ends that year. I remember Rufus French, and I can't remember the other guy, another tight end from, I think it was a Southeastern Conference school, but neither one of those guys got drafted. Rufus French actually went as a free agent. He left early. Mm-hmm. So I'm watching them two to figure out where I'm going. And when I didn't see them get drafted, I'm like, well, I'm not going to get drafted until they get drafted. So it wasn't that stressful for me because he kind of gave me the roadmap. Mm-hmm. But it was a great experience, you know, having family and friends there, knowing that I'm not going to get drafted to like the last day. I wasn't sitting there panicking the first 2 days. I was just enjoying the experience. And when the phone rang at the beginning of the sixth round, middle of sixth round, whenever it was, you know, it was just all joy because a goal or a dream, I should say a dream, was now potentially reality.
Sure.
So it was all a joy. It wasn't really much stress at all.
Well, I guess then looking at that then, you know, once you arrived in Denver, like, what was it like learning to be a pro? Because it is a different world, man. Like, it's funny watching my dad watch baseball because he gets so frustrated watching some players. And you look at it and you're like, right, but they were the best somewhere. Like, you have some right. incredible people and they're all in one place. So what is that like, you know, learning how to be a pro and kind of getting in this level where all these guys are incredible?
Well, that's the first thing that I noticed when I got there. All these guys are incredible. Admittedly, I was intimidated because I'm playing behind Shannon Sharp. You mm-hmm. know, I'm on a team that just won two Super Bowls.
It's incredible to me, by the way, the shape that Shannon Sharp is still in.
Still in, yes.
Oh, my God.
But it's a lifestyle for him. You know yeah. what I'm saying? It's a lifestyle. And then playing behind Dwayne Carswell, they call him House. You know, he eventually made a Pro Bowl. Byron Chamberlain, he left Denver and went to Minnesota, made a Pro Bowl. All of these guys are super-duper talented. Mm-hmm. And I'm just watching them like, man, like I can't do half the stuff that they're doing. So my whole mindset was kind of stuck on, I'm not going to make this team. It wasn't until I started focusing on myself and started focusing on trying to make myself the best player that I could be mm-hmm. and not worrying about those people is when I kind of started to assimilate myself into being a professional. Mm-hmm. And once I made the team, and they kept four tight ends that year, which usually don't do,
yeah.
especially not back in those days. It was Shannon Sharp. It was Dwayne Carswell. It was Byron Chamberlain that welcomed me into that group and treated me like family and showed me what it was to be a professional. It was the Rod Smiths of the world that, you know, seeing him work out in the offseason every year, like that's how you be a professional. So again, it's having that exposure to really good people. And I could have went into a tight end room that sucked.
Yeah.
And it would have probably derailed my career, especially because I wasn't confident going into training camp. And those guys never made me feel uncomfortable. Those guys, they made me feel welcome and they all helped me. Now, if I wouldn't have had that, who knows? I probably wouldn't have made it my first year.
I guess then looking at it, like one of the biggest things that I think, whether it's in football or whether it's in different things, is the regiments we set up for ourselves and the way we prepare and things like that. And I guess like looking at it, you know, you learn to be a pro. What did your preparation and things look like? Because I know like, you know, you look at some of these guys like Vernon Davis. Vernon Davis, you know, was incredible in prowess for his weightlifting. Like the guy could power clean, you know, more than I could walk around carrying. So I guess like for you, like what things did you focus on then to be the best of your craft?
Yeah, I started focusing on myself. Mm-hmm. A scout gave me this piece of information. He said, every day, go out with one focus that you want to get better on, mm-hmm. no matter how big or small, just one little thing that you're focused on. Mm-hmm. And so the rest of the preparation is kind of set up for you because there's a regimen. Mm-hmm. Wednesday, we do this. Thursday, we do this. Friday, we do this. Saturday, we travel. Sunday, game. We win. Monday, we come in and watch everything on our own. Tuesday, day off. So everything is kind of set for you. Mm-hmm. I think it's more about the mindset that you have with attacking it.
Sure.
And for me, you know, I wasn't a big time weight room guy, but I was a big time worker on the field. Mm-hmm. And my thing was always to figure out something that I could go out intentionally practice on being better at every single day.
Mm-hmm. So when you're saying working on the field, you're talking about like your route running, your blocking, stuff like that.
Yeah. Just technique stuff. And sometimes it's the mental stuff. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you can have practices where you mess up three plays in a practice. And, you know, if you do that in the game, that hurts. Some days it was just, hey, I'm not going to have any mental errors. Or mm-hmm. some days I'm not going to have any drops. Or, you know, if a guy had been getting the best of me, well, today I'm going to make sure that I don't get beat by this guy at all. Mm-hmm. So it was always something that I could focus on. And having that mental focus, and I don't care what you're doing. I don't care if you're an insurance salesman or doing podcasts like you're doing, but
right.
you got to have that mental focus to be at the top of your game every day.
I guess then looking at it, you know, the bulk of your career you did spend with the Chicago Bears, and you hold, you know, second place in just about every category there is behind Mike Ditka, which is pretty incredible, man. You played for Coach Lovie Smith, which I really think is, he's one of the class acts in football. And I guess like looking at it, you know, why do you feel like you blossomed in Chicago? And, you know, what was it like playing for Coach Smith and what he expected from you?
Yeah, I think to answer the first question, why I blossomed in Chicago, I had a really good coach. Mm-hmm. I had a really good tight ends coach. Rob Boris, what he did for me, he always answered the questions, how and why.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have that like my first 4 years of playing in the NFL. My fifth year, I had a pretty good coach. But once Rob got there, my sixth year, I believe that's when I started to be better. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't, man, you just got to go out and do this and get this done. He told me how to do it. And he told me why I needed to be doing it this way. And that made it easier for me to buy in. When you know why, then mm-hmm. you could buy in. Of course, you got to know how. He was a guy that not only taught the physical game, but also the mental game.
Sure.
And I believe it was because of his tutelage that when I got to Chicago, I became a better blocker. I was never known for being a blocker my mm-hmm. first 4 or 5 years in the NFL. It wasn't until he got there, and I didn't change my physique or anything. I was still mm-hmm. a small tight end. I mean, coaching means a lot. Mm-hmm. And then with Coach Smith, his ways of being a head coach with how I want to grow my business also.
Mm.
What he did, he gave us ownership of the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
He gave that to us. That's what you guys do. You know, I'm going to trust you as men. We have captains. When the captains come up and talk to me, we got issues or whatnot. I listen to the captains. And most of the time, he gave us our way. Mm-hmm. As long as we were working hard and getting the job done, he didn't have any problems. If
sure.
we went up and said we needed a day off or not a day off or no pads or whatever it may be, he would listen. And that made us want to play that much more harder for him
mm.
because we never want to lose what we had as a team, as a culture, and as an organization. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, when you have a great leader like that who lets you be you and he lets you, you know, have ownership, take ownership of how you get your job done, mm-hmm. you know, you love that as an employee or as a player.
And, you know, you guys did go to a Super Bowl with Chicago. Like, what is that like, man? What's that like playing on the biggest stage?
Man, who was the guy that just did a $10 million deal for podcasts, $100 million deal?
Oh, Joe Rogan.
Joe Rogan. So I always try to relate it to what other people are doing. So
sure.
it'd be like you signing that $100 million deal that Joe Rogan did for his podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the top of the top. You cannot,
right.
that's the highest deal for a podcast ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it's like to play in the Super Bowl. Like, you can't get any higher than being a football player and playing in the Super Bowl. So whatever you do, just think about the highest achievement that you could have
mm-hmm.
in your world. That's the Super Bowl. And the only thing that's different about it is that we have, you know, a billion people watching it and cheering us on or booing us, whoever, you know, side they're on. And that's the only difference. But
I
know,
can't imagine what the stress is like on that, man. Like, I feel like everything you're doing is heightened. Like, you got to see the ball in and all that kind of stuff. Like, I just can't even imagine.
It's not. I mean, it can be stressful.
Yeah.
If you let it. But
sure.
this is what we do. I've been playing football since the age of 6 years old. This is what we do day in and day out. So it's a job. And just like any job, it can be stressful. But
mm-hmm.
for the most part, you go to work and just do your job. That's how we take it also. I think most of the stress comes leading up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're in the game, you're in the game and you're just playing ball.
Well, I guess I'm looking at it, Des, like, you played in an era where the tight end position, like, it was like revolutionized, and it just like totally changed. Like you look at guys like Tony Gonzalez, you know, you look at towards the tail end of your career, but you look at somebody like Rob Gronkowski, like my personal favorite, Big Bubba Franks. Like you look at a lot of these, you know, tight ends, and the position has changed a lot. I guess in your eyes, like how has the tight end position changed and revolutionized, you know, especially during the time you played?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you have a tight end who can stay on the field all three downs and run block just as well as they can get out and make plays, I mean, you have a distinct advantage. And this may sound a little biased. Outside of the quarterback, I believe the tight end position is the most unique position on the football field.
Well, case in point is you look at what happened with Tom Brady last year when you took Gronk away. Different player.
But think about this. As a tight end, you got to be an offensive lineman.
Yep.
You have to be a receiver. And then sometimes you line up in the backfield and have to be a fullback.
Yeah.
And then you have to know all the blocking assignments from all the positions. And then you got to know all of the route tree, all of the hot routes in it. No other position has to know that much. So when you get a unique athlete that can perform well at all those positions, man, you create so many matchups. I think that's where the tight end position, starting like in the mid-90s all on through now, has changed. And when you look at the good teams in the NFL, they typically have good tight ends. Look at San Francisco, look at Kansas City.
Yeah. Well, I guess in looking at it, we talked about Coach Smith and, you know, I guess like looking at it, like, you know, the Rooney Rule doesn't work. Like, how do we create more opportunity for, you know, African-American coaches in the NFL? Because it needs to happen. You know, I look at a guy like Byron Leftwich and like, I want to see him become a head coach one day. Like, how do we create more opportunity for African-Americans in the NFL?
Right. And I believe it's a larger issue. I mean, the issue that we're dealing with today in society, I think it has more to do with that than anything else, whether you want to call it racist or just bias.
Right.
However you want to put it. I'll leave it to people to put it however they want to put it. But when you have, and this is anybody, when you're going out to hire somebody, you more likely want to hire somebody that has something similar to you. You can relate to them a little better. And that's usually typically what you see. Now, like I say, whether that's racist or bias, that's up to you to handle. But I think when you look at the NFL and you look at who are the players or the employees, there should be more representation on that level also. And I just feel like there are too many qualified candidates out there that's not getting the opportunity. I mean, you look at Bienemy out of Kansas City.
Yeah, I'm shocked Bienemy doesn't have a head coaching job.
Yeah. And then you just look and say, why? And I think it's because you have all white owners and, you know, mostly white general managers that's hiring the coaches. And that's what you tend to get, those people who are having like similarities to the people that's hiring them.
Absolutely. Well, I guess like coming towards, you know, the tail end of your playing career, like you had an experience, Des, where, you know, you lost a lot of money, like $750,000, man. Yeah. It was a lot of money. And a lot of people would look at that and they would get mad and they would go after the person, they would do whatever. But instead, you said, all right, I'm going to get some knowledge. And you figured out how to, you know, learn more about finances and learn more about how to control it. Because you look at a lot of NFL players and like, you know, you guys get paid a lot of money, but for a short period of time. Like for a lot of guys, this is going to be a lifetime earnings. They got to make work. And you look at somebody like Trent Richardson, he was a number one overall pick and his family blew all of his money. So like, I guess, how did that education and seeking that education, like, how did that change the game for you? And I think, I guess, how do players change that game for themselves?
Right. First of all, Trent Richardson family didn't blow out money. He did.
Okay. I had read a couple articles, so, you know.
But, I mean, he has to take it out of his account and put it out there.
Right.
So, you know, and with me, let's not get it twisted. I was pissed. I was upset. I wanted to go after the guy. All those things that you said that I didn't do, I actually did. But it wasn't until I said, you know what? I have to take responsibility for this. You know, let's forget about fault, because fault is, we could point fingers all day. Whose responsibility is it to protect my money? It's only my responsibility.
Right.
Even if I have a financial advisor, even if I invest with someone who I trust, it still comes down to it's my responsibility. So once that sunk in and once I accepted that, that's when I said, okay, I'm not getting that money back. What do I have to do now? And what I needed to do at that point was to make sure that it never happened again. And so that's when I started educating myself, and along with my attorney, who actually found out that I was in a Ponzi scheme. He was an attorney for a financial firm out in the Denver area. That's when I started learning about stocks, bonds, different private placements, this, that, and the other. And it's not rocket science. Mm-hmm. And when I learned the human side of it, of, hey, financial advising is just as much managing people as it is managing money, that's when I fell in love with this profession. And that's why I went down this road of financial services. And I'm in insurance now, but my first 5-6 years in this was primarily financial advising with insurance, but now it's just primarily insurance.
Mm. Well, I guess then, you know, looking at it, one of the things that you did is you've written 2 books since you came out of the league. What made you decide that you wanted to take that next step and just start really educating others? Because it is a little bit more of a selfless idea than some people come up with. So where did that come from for you? And, you know, what inspired you to start writing?
Well, this book right here was more of a personal book. And that one was Before and Beyond the Game. Mm-hmm. So that book was for me. I've always struggled with people just seeing me as a football player because mm-hmm. I feel like I bring much more to the table than just being a football player. Mm-hmm. So the title tells it all, Before and Beyond the Game. I wanted to tell who the person was. And also, you can see it's the person in front with the football player behind. So I wanted to tell that story first. And then I always said I was going to come with the second book and tell more of the philosopher, the philosophical stories and thoughts that I have about myself.
Sure.
And that's the second book, Principles of Winning, when I just put a lot of my experiences out there for the reason just to help other people walk into their vision of themselves and their family and their loved ones. If I can share my experiences, because we talk about experiences and exposure is everything. If I can help somebody, you know, escalate at a faster pace than they might would have on their own, that's what I wrote the book for.
Well, in the second book you're talking about is Principles of Winning, the 5 keys to create a standard of excellence, which actually just came out in April. Yeah. And I totally recommend people pick this up. There's so much to learn from this, Des. And one of the things that you've said is you've said that all you have is your name and your word. And I think that is just such a powerful thing to look at, Des. Where did you learn that lesson? And you know, what does that mean in living that for you?
My coach Jay's, man. Coach Joe, as I had told him I was going to get some things done for him and the team, and I was the quarterback, captain, and you know, I went 2 weeks without doing them. You know, he jacked me up and he laid into me for a little while. That's what he told me. He was like, son, let me tell you something. All you have is your name and your word. And once you lose that, you lost everything.
Yep.
And it really didn't hit me until later on in life about what that meant. But for me right now, everyone has a brand. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to be a company to have a brand. When someone says, Command Your Brand podcast, there's something that people are going to think about that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
When somebody says the name Desmond Clark, there's emotional reaction to hearing that name, whether small, big, or whatever. And you always want that reaction to your brand, your name, to be a positive one. If you're out and you're not doing the right things and you're constantly letting people down and disappointing people and not holding up to your word, well, your name is going to be garbage. And, yep. and once it gets to a certain point, it's hard to recover that. Mm-hmm. People will forgive you once, maybe twice, but after a couple of times, your name is just trash. So, and here's the other side of it. When you mm-hmm. keep your name and your word all the time, now people are more than willing to help you out, give you a helping hand, point you in the right direction, make an introduction for you, work with you because your name is gold mm-hmm. and they want to be part of that. People want to be a part of brands who are consistent and reliable. So that's what I mean about always protect your name and your word, because it will carry you if you do it.
Well, it's vital when you think about it, right? Because economies change, businesses change, careers change. But your name and your word, man, and your skill set, like that's really all you have. And if you just, you know, look at that as your security and not what somebody else is giving you, like that's where it's from, man.
Right. Absolutely. And always, and I use it in the book, my writer, he asked me, he was like, so is protecting your name and your word like kind of protecting your reputation? I was like, no, it's the total opposite. I was like, when you protect your name and your word, your reputation would always protect you. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it's not always going to be peaches and roses. And sometimes we may go off on a tangent or off the rails a little bit, but people know that's not who he is all the time. Mm-hmm. And it happened to me in 2015, getting arrested. But man, I had over 200 and something people write letters to the judge for me. And, you know, all I had to do was send out text messages and they came in by droves. Yeah. So because people understood who I was and they like, yeah, this dude's been.
When people know you're a person of character, they'll come to bat for you, man.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we're not all perfect. And it's going to be some times when, you know, we're going to be less than perfect. But if you've put in enough deposits with your name and your word, mm-hmm. you know, every now and again, you can take out a withdrawal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess then looking at it like through the eyes of leadership, Des, like whether it's on the field or whether it's, you know, in business, you know, you are somebody, you know, helping to build an insurance agency now and really do some incredible things out there. Like, how do you define leadership?
So the first thing that I always say about leadership is that real leaders know that it's not about them. Mm-hmm. I look at leadership like this. If I have someone that has said, hey, Desmond, I'm going to tie into you so you can get me from point A to point Z. Mm-hmm. The most important thing for me is to say, all right, what is your vision? Where are you trying to go? What are you trying to accomplish? And now if I can wrap your vision into the bigger overall vision mm-hmm. of, you know, just say the insurance people company, now we have a match because mm-hmm. now I could take you to where you want to go as we try to build a bigger vision. So that's how I see leadership, as helping people trying to accomplish their visions, their goals, and really being someone who is selfless mm-hmm. and making sure that the people who are watching you and following you get everything that they need to be successful. Because really, at the end of the day, if you can make your people successful, you're going to make yourself successful also.
Well, I guess then, like, you know, looking at it, Des, like, you know, I've listened to a lot of interviews with you. I've read about a lot about what you're doing. And I just, again and again and again, it just comes up that you seem to have this unique ability to just decide something's going to be so, and, you know, it may take you more time or less time, and you just make it so. I guess, like, looking at it, where does that come from for you, man?
I always tell this story. My dad, on his 40th birthday, we were on the beach. And, you know, he was a recovering drug addict. I think he had been clean for maybe 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And he's blind and, you know, we're celebrating July 4th, his birthday. And he has a cigarette in one hand. And he takes his last puff. He's like, I'm too old to be smoking cigarettes. And he just flicked the cigarette, done. He has his glass of cognac in his hand. Takes that last drink. He was like, if I'm going to give up smoking, I might as well give up drinking also.
Wow.
Took his last drink. And that was it.
Wow.
So that was so powerful to me, not in the moment, but later on in life, because I'm like, yeah, okay. but never took another drink, never smoked another cigarette in his life, never relapsed into drugs again. Mm-hmm. So that lets me know if you're committed to something, mm-hmm. and it, you know, it may not be just this easy, but it can be this easy for some people. If you're committed to it, and you say it is so, all you have to do is go and do it.
Mm-hmm. It's that decision, man. I feel like so many people get stuck in the maybe of it, right? It's a yes or a no, decide and make it happen, man. You get stuck in the maybe, you're not going to go anywhere.
I think a lot of people get stuck in what I don't want to happen.
Yeah.
Well, if I do this, what about this? And if we make that decision, what are these people going to think? Or, you know, how's that going to, I can't worry about all the things that might happen and the what ifs or the things that I don't want to happen. You know, because first of all, I know that I'm doing things for what I perceive as the right reasons. Mm-hmm. And so with that being in the backdrop of every decision that I make, you know, I don't have to, like, my conscience is not torn with the decision, so I can move forward. True. Now, are there some things that might happen because you make a decision? Yeah, it might. You may disappoint some people because of the decision that you made, because maybe you don't have enough time to focus over here anymore, or, you know, maybe now that you're making the decision, you know, you're not in their presence anymore for the things that, you know, they kind of counted on you for. For that reason, I made the decision because I'm trying to excel to someone somewhere else. And that was a byproduct for it. You got to make hard decisions sometime and just go in and make it happen.
Well, I guess you and I were talking about a little bit, Des, before we started recording here. And you've said before that it's easier to fight for something than through something. And yeah. I just think that's a beautiful and incredible thing. So tell us what you mean by that, man.
So if you really think about how we get up every day, you know, if you get up with a purpose, with a motive every day, mm-hmm. your days become more focused. Your days become, I'm not going to say less stressful. I'll just say sure. more intentional. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean by easier to fight for something. Because I know what I'm trying to get to. Mm-hmm. I know what point I'm trying to get to. I know my short-term goal is every week I'm trying to write a minimum of 5 households. Mm-hmm. So I know I'm getting up every day and trying to hit that goal every week. And when you have that intentionality about life, when you have that intentionality about your days, it makes your days easier to deal with. Mm-hmm. Because life is hard, man.
Yeah.
If you don't get up with intentionality and motive, on a daily basis, I mean, you can struggle and float from this thing to that thing and look up and, man, you're just in a big quagmire of just nothingness. Life can take over if you don't take over life.
Well, I guess then looking at it then, just as we're kind of running a little low on time here, but if you were to look at like something that Dez believed at 21 that you don't believe now, what would you say that is?
Oh, Dez believed at 21. Man, that's hard to say. I was told recently that I've been the same person since I've been in high school.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely say this. Dez don't believe in doing as much drinking as he did when he was 23, 24, 25.
That's definitely a good decision.
I would say that a ton more focused than I was when I was 21. Mm-hmm. But as far as things that I don't believe in now that I used to believe in then, I don't know if it's anything that I could say that I used to believe in then that I still don't believe in to this day.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I guess then like looking at the idea of legacy, Dez, like, you know, if we were far in the future and you could kind of decide what that legacy you're going to leave behind looks like, you know, tell us what the legacy looks like, man.
Yeah. Someone asked the question of who is my primary audience for everything that I do. Mm-hmm. My primary audience for everything that I do are my kids, mm-hmm. are my family. I want them to take away from me and all of these things that I'm doing, you know, writing books. Actually, my first book I wrote was for them. So wow. I actually wrote 3 books. But I want my legacy to be when I'm gone, the things that I've done continue to live on, publishing and things like that. Having a company that I can say, hey, I helped build and have for my kids to be able to say, you know what, my dad did some pretty good things while he was here. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could leave with them walking tall, walking proud and saying, I had a damn good father, that's more than enough for me.
As somebody that's only 2 years into this fatherhood journey, man, I can really appreciate that. There's nothing that you realize you love more until you have a kid. It's incredible.
Exactly. And man, just wait till he or she grows up and you start having these conversations and then they're like 8 and then they get into like the sports or activities and then they become teenagers and you're having the teenage conversations. Oh man, it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, Dez, we've talked about a lot of different topics today. We've talked about your career. We've talked about what you're doing with the insurance people, your writing. If you could leave the people listening to this, you know, one piece of advice or one lesson, what would that be?
One of my major goals when I interact with people is to leave them better than when they met me. I don't know if I do that. I'm quite sure I don't do that all the time, but it's always a goal. And here's something that I picked up over the last month or two, and I love this quote. Mm-hmm. People don't rise to the level of their expectations. They fall to the level of their training.
Mm.
And that quote is so powerful because, yeah, you can have all the expectations in the world, but if you're not constantly training yourself to get better and better and better and better every day, mm-hmm. you're going to continuously let down yourself. And that's mm-hmm. the last thing that you want to do. We all let down other people and do things that, you know, we will want to do better, but to continuously let down yourself, mm-hmm. that's when people go into depression. That's when people have personal struggles. So just always remember that the expectations can be whatever they want to, but make the training just as lofty and as detailed and as intentional as you want your expectations, as those expectations that you want to match.
Well, Dez, this has been amazing today, my friend. I know I've learned a ton. Our audience has learned a ton. I'm sure they're going to want to go check you out and follow you. Where's going to be the best place for them to go?
Yeah, Instagram, Twitter. I think both of those are DezClark88, at DezClark88. I do most of my posting and writing and stuff on LinkedIn. So go and, man, I promise you, I will get to you if you make a connection on LinkedIn. But I got a lot of them to go. But that's where I do most of my stuff. Of course, Facebook is out there just with my name. But at DezClark88 on LinkedIn and Twitter. And yeah, I do a ton of stuff and just try to get the good messages out there, man, because especially in today's world, I mean, we all need to be lifting each other up.
Absolutely. Well, Desmond Clark, thank you so much for hanging out with me today on the Create Your
Absolutely.
Own Life Show.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.